that? That's what an estimated 500 horsepower sounds like. How about that? That's a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system with 18 speakers and a Beosonic sound experience. And that, that's our legacy. You ready to be a part of it? Unlock the energy of the all-electric ZDX Type S. Order now at Acura.com.
Who doesn't love a classic chocolate chip cookie? Famous Amos has been making them since the 70s. 1975, to be exact. With semi-sweet chocolate chips and a satisfying crunch, it's everything classic in one bite-sized cookie. And fans couldn't get enough. That's right. You'll find our original recipe, the one you know and love, in every bag of Famous Amos original chocolate chip cookies. Find Famous Amos anywhere you buy your favorite snacks.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Do you want a beautiful lawn? Enter True Green, the easiest way to get a great lawn. Just water and mow, and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and more. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour, and they have a verified best price, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit truegreen.com, TRUGREEN.com, to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people. Guaranteed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Looking for a fun way to win 25 times your money this football and basketball season? Test your skills on Prize Picks, the most exciting way to play daily fantasy sports. Just select two or more players, pick more or less on their projection for a wide variety of stats, and place your entry. It's as easy as that. If you have the skills, you can turn $10 into $250 with just a few taps. Easy gameplay, quick withdrawals, and injury insurance on your picks are what make Prize Picks the number one daily fantasy sports app. Ready to test your skills? Join the Prize Picks community of more than 7 million players who have already signed up. Right now, Prize Picks will match your first deposit up to $100. Just visit prizepicks.com/play100 and use code play100. That's code play100 at prizepicks.com/play100 for a first deposit match up to $100. Prize Picks, daily fantasy sports made easy.
What's up? It's Kaylee Cuoco. When it comes to travel, we all have a happy place. I just went to my happy place. I just went to Maui, and it was truly amazing. Priceline has always been about getting you to your happy place for a happy price, with deals you really can't find anywhere else, like up to 60% off select hotels in Costa Rica or 5-star hotels for 2-star prices in Cabo.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Want to know more about Fred Spofforth's moustache, or the time Vizzy got stumped looking like a buffoon, or any other great stories from cricket's past? Well, I have a history of cricket podcast called Double Century. And luckily for you, Season 3 has just started. This time we look at something that will please cricket fans around the world, except maybe from one country, because we're looking at the first time teams defeated England. It's a different kind of podcast series in that it's mostly narrated, but there will also be some key episodes that I'm interviewing the players involved. You can hear this by finding Double Century in your favourite podcast app.
Hello, welcome to another Spotify Green Room Wagon Wheel chat. So if you're listening to this live, you are in the room with me. And you are hopefully lining up to ask questions already, or at least thinking about questions, or thinking about something, thinking about life. If you're listening to this on my podcast, then it's already been recorded, and you can join in just by following Twitter, really. And I usually put out the tweets there telling people when I'm going to go live on the Wagon Wheel. And if you're doing this on YouTube, you can see my face. And I don't really know what else you need to know. But if you do want to get involved with these Spotify Green Rooms, the best thing to do is download the app, follow me, you get a notification, and then you come in and you ask your questions. And some people have already asked. Well, they haven't already asked some questions, but they're already here. So, Causa, are you there?
Yeah.
How you doing?
Yesterday, you know, Australia got beaten by Bangladesh. A young lad called, you'll have to watch him, Ashish Hossain. He's kind of a batsman like Morgan and what I can say that, you know, elegant, but they are not really test specialists. You know that they will not never play test cricket, just like, you know, Yuvraj Singh or any other, you know, David Miller, this kind of batsman. So why do you think batsmen are coming? Yeah, they are white ball elegant cricketers, but you'll not feel that they can play red ball cricket. So why do you think this kind of cricketers are coming from our this systems? Because before, you know, when there were no ODI cricket or white ball cricket,
I got you. This is easy. First thing is that we've only started taking white ball cricket seriously for about 30 years. So before that, everyone was trained to be red ball specialist. So of course you wouldn't have had many white ball specialists, right? So that makes that's the first part of it. The second part of it is that if you are Aaron Finch or Owen Morgan or who else did you mention? You mentioned Yuvraj Singh. I can't remember his test record off the top of my head. But those sorts of players who are specialists in white ball, usually it's because they have a weakness, which in red ball you can't hide. You know, with Aaron Finch, if you put three slips in with him, he will eventually nick off. He nicks a lot. You know, that is a huge problem. If you bowl stumps to Aaron Finch in a test match, he's not going to be able to flick every ball over, you know, mid-wicket for six, and eventually he's going to miss one and he's going to go out. That sort of risk and reward in a one-day game can cost you a lot of runs. So there are very basic reasons why there are players. You are talking about, it's called limited overs cricket, but in some ways it's a limited form of cricket. That all the dismissals are not always available to you, all the fielding positions are not always available. Also, the pitches are flatter, so that helps very good stroke makers. And the balls are absolutely garbage. White balls are terrible. We don't talk about this enough. They're disgusting. They're painted. We have to have two of them in a one-day game because they don't even last, right? So that, again, gives a huge advantage to someone who's just going to play through the line. If you're the sort of player who can play through the line all day, you will be successful in white ball cricket more often than not. If you try and do that in red ball cricket, the balls wobble around a little bit. They do things. They generally stay harder. They spin more. They bounce more. They do all the sorts of things that it's completely different. So it is a fundamentally, I did this last week, this whole fundamental thing. It is a completely different sport, I think is the best way of looking at it now. And, you know, I'm not sure enough people who actually are willing to admit to that. So they are different sports. So if you're asking why we have players who are good at it and players who are not good at it, it's because it's a different sport. Great question. Thank you. Vigish.
Hey, Jared.
How you doing?
Yeah, I'm good. So I just wanted to ask a very simple question about how people perceive test cricket should be played. So yesterday...
That is not a simple question. But go.
Yeah, whenever it was that when England, in the recent series, England was bowled out for 183. In the first innings by India, it was swinging, it was seaming, all the pacers took the wickets and they got bowled out for below 200. The same happened in Australia. When Australia were bowled out for below 200 more than a couple of times in the recent series in January. So when all that happened, there was no uproar. It was all about people's batting techniques and all that, how they couldn't handle the moving ball. But when the same England versus India test series happened in India and the same England got bowled out for below 200, the problem was all about the bowlers and the pitch. Is there a perception that if you get seamed out or swung out, it is the batsman's fault? And if you get spun out, it's the bowlers or the pitch's fault?
Well, no, because every time we ever talk about spinning pitches, all I ever get is the exact opposite from Asian fans who say, what about the pitchers who swing and seam all the time? So, no, it just depends on your background, really, of what you think is more normal.
I don't care either way, as long as there is a good bowling and good batting. Like, I don't care either way, but
I think people speak
about it. It's always in the wrong connotation. Like, if it's a green track, it's a very nice track, greenish track. But if it's a dust bowl, there is sort of a bad connotation around the language that we use for spinning pitches.
Yeah. I mean, this question is asked almost on every wagon wheel, but fundamentally, there is one huge difference between what you have just said. When England were bowled out for 183, it wasn't because of the green pitch. The pitch is not particularly green. It's because the ball swung in the air. That is something that cannot be controlled in the same way. Now, you can argue, if you want, that more grass on the wicket will make the ball swing for longer. But to be honest, I think unless you have an actual abrasive surface, which you don't really make, it's just not something that is natural in England or some of the other places as well. Maybe New Zealand is another place. The ball's going to continue to swing if the ball's going to continue to swing. These balls are swinging because the Duke's balls, for whatever reason this summer, are completely juiced up. And they cannot stop swinging. We haven't seen any reverse swing in a test match in England this year because the balls have just not stopped conventionally swinging at the moment. That's not the pitch. That is the ball and the conditions, which is a completely different thing from the pitch. If you were talking about massive seam movement, generally people do complain about pitches that have massive seam movement. Not me. I think incredible seam movement's a lot of fun in a test match. But people do usually complain when that's the case. But that is the big difference between spinning pitches and English pitches, if you want. It's that quite often the damage that is done on English pitches has very little to do with the wicket itself. I would say that the amount of seam movement I've seen in this test is not that much different than you would expect in somewhere like Australia, which isn't really known for seam movement. What we've seen is the ball is just ridiculously bending. It seems to swing more the later we get into the innings. I think with India, it swung more after the 45 over mark than it did before that, which is absolutely baffling. And I would say that England seemed to swing it later in the innings. Although, what are they, about 25 overs in when it really started to bend around corners for them. Again, that's probably even late for a Duke's ball to start swinging at that amount. So that's not a green pitch. That's not seam bowling. So straight away, if you're going to say what you're saying, you have to look at it from that perspective. The other thing is, and as I said, I do talk about this almost every green room, is that they are fundamentally different things. If the ball seams a lot on day one, it may not seem a lot on day three. If the ball spins a lot on day one, it's probably going to be almost impossible to bat by day three. So there are quite often different situations the way that they do that. Also, if the ball seams, can quite often help spin bowlers as well. Even if the ball swings, it can quite often help spin bowlers as the ball might drift a little bit more as well. Again, when the ball spins a lot, generally we don't see seamers. So there is key differences here. But there's also, I don't want to say racial differences, but there are the Australia and England set the table on how we talk about cricket because Australia was the best team in it and England invented the laws and shipped it around to all of our countries. And there's almost no spin in England. And spin in Australia is something that you bowl in the middle overs when you're resting your quicks and rotate your quicks outside of a couple of great spinners that they have had. So, of course, they're going to see spin differently to other places. But we still have to get the facts right. If we're going to talk about this, we can't say, oh, look, England got bowled out for 183. Why is no one talking about the green pitch? Because it wasn't a green pitch. Had a green tinge, but it wasn't seeming around like crazy. So if we're going to talk about these things, we have to be accurate with them and we have to actually understand all the different parts of it. So the opposite conversation to what you're having is terrible, but if we're going to have the informed conversation, which is what you want, you have to be accurate. You can't say that was a green pitch because the ball swung and the ball is swinging. And that is something that is not as controllable, especially in England, where the pitches are just not abrasive. They're not abrasive surfaces. Outside of occasionally, you might get one in Manchester. It does happen at the Oval. But most of the pitches aren't abrasive. So the balls don't fall apart. They stay together. And for this particular batch of Duke's balls, they're nuclear when they stay together. They just keep swinging. I think when India started swinging the ball massively, I think it was in Bumrah's second or third spell, I assumed it was a reverse swing. Because the ball looked like it wasn't it was a little bit dinged up. And then I think Mohammed Shami came on and started swinging it. It was quite clearly conventional swing again. It's phenomenal the way these balls have managed to continue to swing up until the 79th over until they're getting replaced. I can't remember. Was it one of the New Zealand, I don't know if it was the World Test Championship or the England game, where the ball was swinging so much in the 70th over conventionally, 79th over, that I'm not sure they were talking about not taking it, the new ball. What a remarkable situation that is. And that's not normal for England. Generally, it does stop swinging. Reverse swing plays a part in England. Spin generally plays a bigger part in England after the 50th over mark. That's not been this summer. And sometimes you do get a batch of balls that are a little bit different. But great question. Thank you very much. Who do we have coming up here? There you are. What's your question? Very good. How can I help you?
My question was, if you are Pujara in England or in South Africa, how are you going to score your runs? Because you don't attack as much as players do. So if you just keep on defending, how are you going to get your runs?
Well, I mean, I don't really understand the question. Also, playing in England and South Africa is completely different. You know, similar wickets in that, well, similar that the ball could swing, but different balls and different pitches, I think, fun. But how is he going to score? Well, he's going to score the same way he does kind of everywhere. He's going to take all the pressure. He's going to try and tire out the bowlers. He's going to wait for any poor deliveries. And he's going to rotate the strike when he sees it as a safe option for him to do so. Pujara doesn't bat that much differently to a normal English batter, I would have thought. He is probably less likely to try and steal singles. That's not really his game. He's a terrible runner between wickets as much as anything. And he likes to use the full face of the bat, perhaps slightly more than a traditional English top order player, where they will open and close the face a little bit more in looking for singles. But realistically, he doesn't bat that much different than an England top order player. Cook, Trott, all very, very similar players to Pujara. Just that they are, I think, Trott's strike rate is about 45, 46, and Pujara's is about 43, 44. He has a game plan where he tries to tire out bowlers over time, especially outside of Asia, where he can't attack the spinners and make a bit of a mark there. Tries to tire out quick bowlers. He tries to negate their... he tries to essentially wait for a magic ball to get him out. Now, the problem in England this particular summer is I'm not sure you can tire out bowlers particularly well, because the ball's going to keep swinging, so they're going to feel like they're in the game a little bit longer. And also, it's very hard to negate the ball if it never stops swinging. You can do that in Australia, because if Pujara's faced 100 balls, the ball's probably not doing as much for at that point, whereas that doesn't seem to be the case here. Also, he's never made runs consistently in England, which might mean that there are more magic balls in England. And you do need to, and his method of waiting them out perhaps hasn't quite worked for him. But I don't see how he's going to change. He is Pujara. He's an incredible test batter around the world. And we know what he can do. And his job really is going to be to take as much time out of it, especially if Stokes is not playing. The one chance that India does have is perhaps tiring out the England bowlers. In this particular case, Sam Curran is I don't want to say a fragile fourth bowler, but he's not a regular fourth bowler in Test cricket. He usually has that backup. It's a very one-dimensional attack, the England attack as well. There's no, you know, frontline spin option. So Pujara will probably bat the exact same way he does. I don't think he'll be successful, not because there's anything, you know, particularly wrong with his method, but clearly there is something within the way he bats that does not transfer to England. We've seen that in county cricket and we've seen that in test cricket. He just does not consistently make runs. And there has to be a reason for that, whether it be technical. I doubt it's mental at this stage. But I don't see how, I mean, what are we expecting to do? Start playing switch hits or closing and opening the face? This is not his game. He has his game and he's very good at it.
Is Pujara really getting good balls or is he now making good?
No, he's getting good balls.
The similar pattern?
Yeah, he's getting out to similar patterns. Absolutely incredible test match balls is what he's getting out to. He's getting out to Pat Cummins bowling leg cutters at 90 miles an hour. You know what I mean? Like, he's getting out to phenomenal cricket deliveries. And it takes a phenomenal cricket delivery to get Pujara out. You're not going to get him out with a bog ordinary delivery. thought the delivery to get him out in this particular, in this particular innings was a really good one. But yeah, I certainly understand your question, but I don't see how, I really don't see how he's going to change his game now when he's 100 years old and he knows what he's doing. Whether it works or not is a completely different argument, but I'm not sure that Pujara has the ability to play in a different way because he's so single-minded and one-dimensional. So he's either going to work this out or he's probably not going to be around by the fifth test. I think that's very, very fair. Thanks for your question. I just got one coming through from Connor who says he's working at the moment or doing some schoolwork at the moment, so he can't quite talk, but he wants to ask my opinion on Australia's lack of batting depth. Australia's lack of batting depth, I would say, goes back to the generation of which George Bailey, Mark Cosgrove, I'm trying to think who else, probably missing a couple of names there, when they came through, that was the first generation where I saw very, very talented batters probably not get to the level that the players had beforehand. Now, it could just be that there is a bad batting generation, and perhaps I was just expecting, you know, Cosgrove, Bailey, and I'm not picking on those two because I think they're both very good players, but you could put Voges in this, maybe perhaps Marcus North. The period before that, guys who I thought were of similar talent were averaging 45, 50, and then suddenly people started averaging 35, 40. They didn't dominate county cricket in the same way. Now, perhaps English cricket had gone up. They didn't do that. When they came into the test team, they looked a lot more flawed, and nothing has really changed in that. And then if you go through to the next generation, you've got Curtis Patterson, or Michael Klinger probably goes back in that original generation. So you've got Curtis Patterson, you've got Nick Maddison, Chris Lynn. Again, you have incredibly naturally talented players. In this case, Curtis Patterson, made that 100 when he was a fetus in Shield cricket. Did okay when he played in his tests, but I don't think anyone thinks he is a test quality player consistently, and he certainly hasn't made the runs of a test quality player consistently. Chris Lynn and Nick Maddison got sucked into the white ball cricket, and Chris Lynn, I still think, in another generation, probably goes on to be an incredible number five or number six for Australia. His eye and his ability to play seam bowling specifically is on another level, but he doesn't have a fully formed game. Now, how much of that is the Big Bash being thrown in the middle of the summer? Probably has a role to play. But as I said, this goes back well beyond the Big Bash. Australian batting standards have been dipping for quite a long time. The fact that they had to go back and find Chris Rogers, for instance, who was of that previous generation to shore up their batting, you could argue, I suppose, Adam Voges is another one. Although for a long time in his career, I just think he didn't fully use his talents to the best of his ability. But there's absolutely no doubt in my mind that there is a weakened batting in Australia all the way through the levels of cricket that you see. Someone like Travis Head has massive flaws within his game and yet is continually pushed because I don't think they believe there's someone else. Matt Renshaw was thrust into the team despite the fact he could pretty much only score on one side of the wicket when they found him. You know, they're looking for, you know, absolute gun young players, and there aren't fully formed young players. Even Cameron Green feels like, I can see why everyone was so impressed by him, but it was quite clear from almost the very first ball he faced in Test cricket that he plants his front foot, and that's not a great technique for DRS. Now, white ball cricket has played a part. The splitting of the season has played a part. Also, the second 11 competition that was devalued by Cricket Australia probably has played a part. But I believe at the moment, for whatever reason, Australia is producing much better bowlers than it is batters. Now, that might have something to do with the Shield wickets. There could be a bunch of different things, but it's a concern. But I would say it's been an ongoing concern for a long time. And Australia has, I don't want to say ignored it, but not focused on it. And it hasn't been fixed, and it hasn't fixed itself. That suggests to me that it's not a period where we just haven't produced good batting talent. It's a period where we haven't developed these guys into better batters, would be my guess. But thank you very much for that, Connor. Are you?
Hey, Jared, how are you?
Very good. What's your question?
So I wanted to firstly, say that I really loved your answer on the Olympics and, on Australia being a multi-sport country. I absolutely agree with that statement and, I really appreciate that.
Oh, thank you.
And my question is actually something that you have spoken in the first 2 months, but I have already thought about it since last week. So my question is that, do you think cricket balls are need some have some space of improvement. Do you think pink ball does have the right dimensions? And my thing is that why is there no case made for having just one manufacturer manufacturing the ball, like be it Dukes, Kukabura or SG, and that being the ultimate ball used, and rather than having three different major manufacturers defining their
market. Okay, yeah, I've got all that. I'm obsessed with this. So let's start with that last question. I think you need to understand the fact that SG are experts in making balls in India and Kookaburra and Dukes are not. So straight away, I think you would have a problem if you were to expect Kookaburra or Dukes to perfect a ball in Asian conditions when it has not been their stated aim for a large part of their existence. Secondly, I think the absolute worst thing we can do is make one company the ball manufacturer. And I will point this out by saying that Kookaburra make the white balls and they're still shit, right? They are the white ball ODI T20 ball of choice, and they are an absolutely dreadful cricket ball that is not up to scratch. Now, this is not just Kookaburra's fault because they have to be painted. You can't dye the leather white. So I do understand that. That's not just Kookaburra's fault. But fact is, I really do think we could have a better limited overs ball now if we had more competition in the market. In fact, I think we would have better test match balls if we had more competition in the market. So I would prefer more cricket ball manufacturers. But you have to understand, it was really interesting. I was talking about this with Jeremy Coney, Adam Collins, and I think Nagesh Raghani yesterday. We're doing the commentary on this test series, and during the rain break, we were talking about balls. You have to understand how small these companies are. Dukes is like a tiny, tiny little company. Platypus, who was Australia's test ball for generations, was this factory that I used to go past on the tram when I used to go into the city. And it was this like tiny little place, and yet it was the test ball. We think of these companies, and even Kookaburra, every time someone slams Kookaburra, Kookaburra go out of the way to go, we're just a small manufacturer of sporting goods. They're not like this big, they're not Nike or Adidas, right? That's what I want. I want Nike or Adidas or Puma or Reebok or anyone to be like, we want to get involved here, because what we really need is that competitiveness. We want the skills of Duke, but we want the finances of these big companies, because we want people investing in it. To go to your point on the pink ball's nowhere near as good as it needs to be because no one spent any money on it. At best, at absolute best, $5 million was spent on research and development of that ball. And it wasn't $5 million. It was probably $2 million. It's probably $1.5 million, right? And that includes shipping people out to the UAE to face it and, you know, getting Rahul Dravid to face it and all those sorts of things. We're talking about $1 billion change the pink ball can make. You're taking test cricket, which is played in the daytime, which gets daytime ad revenues, and putting it in prime time, which would mean prime time ad revenues. The difference there is astronomical of what you could do. The pink ball could literally be worth $1 billion in a 10-year cycle, and we spent less than $5 million researching it. And it's not good enough, right? And we continually do this. So, no, I want a space race between the ball manufacturers. I want everyone involved. If the ICC was run properly and not run by the boards, so it was run as an independent thing, and I think the best thing they could do is go to all the biggest sports manufacturers in the world and go, do you want to have the test ball? We're going to have a competition. Let all of them pump $500,000 of research into it to see if they can come up with a better cricket ball than what we currently have. Maybe there is a cricket ball then at that stage that can be used on every surface. But yeah, the way that we choose cricket balls, the way that we talk about cricket balls, the way that cricket balls develop, I just don't think it's good enough. And there's some incredible people that work at Dukes and Kookaburra and SG, and we're not backing them with because our sport is not run correctly, essentially. Does that answer your question?
Yes, Jared. I kind of get the perspective of having Nike and Adidas have been the reason. Yeah, I agree.
Beautiful. Thank you very much for your question, mate.
Thank you, John.
Koza's back. Koza, what's your follow-up?
I'm back. Okay. So, you know, what do you think about the future of cricket analysts, the computer analysts, you know, like you are working with the CPL team, I really can't remember.
I've worked with lots of teams.
Well, I had only heard that one, you know, hard.
No, that's right. So what's your specific question there?
So my question is, how did you start or how to start from scratch, like, you know, starting, hoping to start
Yeah, I didn't start from scratch when it comes to being an analyst because I was basically headhunted from being a journalist. Melbourne Stars were the first team who contacted me, but I ended up working for St. Lucia Stars, who are now St. Lucia Kings, but they were St. Lucia Zooks. So, yeah, I was headhunted from being a journalist. But basically, it comes down to this. What can you tell teams that they don't already know? That's what they want. They want information. We talk about analysis and we talk about, you know, all these different parts of it. When I talk to teams and they say, oh, you know, do you do Moneyball and do you do all, you know, what do you do? And I'm like, I do due diligence. I look up the things that people in cricket teams don't look up. I find things, I discuss things, I take a conversation from a cricketer or a commentator says something and I look it up to see if it's true and I you know, and I crunch numbers, I look for more information and I try and allow for my team to be as educated as possible when they go into any particular game. And that is what I do kind of consistently and that's why I, well, was used to get work before COVID. I haven't had anything since then. But that's what the gig is, really. You are trying to get information for a team in any way possible. It's not just you know, crunching data. It could be anything. I like to go down and watch the opposition train with binoculars. I like to see who's warming up for the opposition team, you know, before a game. That's the sort of thing that I see from an analyst, and that is what teams want. Teams want to know what they don't know. We all want to know what we don't know. Unless we don't want to know what we don't know. I'm very Donald Rumsfeld at this point, but thank you very much for your question. All right, who have we got here?
Hi, Derek. Can you hear me?
I can. What's your question?
Yeah, I wanted to ask your opinion on what you think about the current state of one-day internationals. To me, it feels like an extended form of T20s with all these new introductions of these two new balls and all these new power play restrictions with favor batsmen. This feels like, and like the ODI averages have shot up by like 50, 60 over the past 10 years. I don't feel like watching ODIs anymore because they feel like an extended form of T20s where even the strategies in one-day internationals have not evolved. As in like in T20, we've seen enormous understanding over the last 10 years about the different strategies and what to do and stuff. But I feel like one-day internationals are not in that particular space. So what do you think about this?
Yeah, I disagree with you. We just saw a World Cup where everyone bowled bounces in the middle overs. That's not an accident. That was a strategy that had come out of probably the last couple of years of one-day cricket. That's not a thing that you see in T20 cricket, partly because you can't. I think it's bowling consistent bounces in T20 cricket is so risky. A couple of top edges for six and it's a huge over. Whereas in one-day cricket, it's like a couple of top edges for six, but eventually that person's going to hit the ball straight up in the air and we're going to catch them. So that was a huge change. England have completely changed the way that we think about one-day cricket, surely. The middle overs, they are scoring at, you know, a run a ball in those middle overs. Their batting order, you know, batting deep. They bat deeper in one-day cricket than they do in T20 cricket. Have other teams caught up? Perhaps no, but that's why England won a World Cup. You've got teams like Pakistan and New Zealand who back their bowling attacks. Again, not specifically something you see that much in T20 cricket. Partly just because of the kind of format of the game. You know, if you've got Rashid Khan in your team, you might do it. But certainly New Zealand or Pakistan looked after their bowlers. But, I mean, I don't think your question's wrong in that there's certainly a push and pull between one-day cricket and T20 cricket. That is true. I think you just separate the two by... I would get rid of the fifth bowler option in one-day cricket, make it 12 overs. Or what 12 overs and 13 overs, whatever Australia did in their domestic competition 1 year. I think that is probably something that you can do quite easily. But other than that, I don't know. I feel like it is a different format of the game, but it still needs to be a lot of runs because that is the way that white ball cricket is marketed. But there probably has to be like a very, I don't know, what would you call it? Like a very even mix between T20 cricket and red ball cricket in one day cricket going forward, if it's going to continue as a format. And we're a long way away from that, but it's the most tinkered with format of cricket ever. And so I assume they're going to make 1200 changes between now and the end of my sentence.
Well, what do you think of like the averages which have increased since T20's introduction? Like I remember you seeing ODIs where 250 was the par score. Now 300, 310, like, especially in the World Cup, 300, 310s were the par scores. So what do you think of that particular term?
The first thing you need to know is that 300 is nowhere near the par score. There's only been one team who has consistently scored at a runner ball in ODI cricket ever, and that's England. That's one team. I think India scores at about 280 runs as their general total. Australia's around the same. I think the average in one day cricket's 264. It's not that high. We focus on a lot of the high scores. There's a lot of low scores in one day cricket as well. In fact, a lot of the regulations that they brought in, especially back about 4 or 5 years ago, we either had very high scores or very low scores, which is probably ideal for one day cricket, I would have thought. Yeah, players are better at batting in white ball cricket now because they spend more of their time thinking about white ball batting. And one day cricket, if you're someone like Owen Morgan or Joe Root, Baba Azam, and you're, you know, an incredible batter, Virat Kohli, Kane Williamson, Steve Smith, and everything is in your favor, you should be able to score at about 5.5, 6 runs and over without losing a wicket in white ball cricket. That's what one day cricket should be, I think, at a certain point. Because that's never going to be possible in red ball cricket. The red ball moves too long. The pitches are, degrade quicker, usually more bowler friendly. The balls are better, all those sorts of things. So you really, if we can't improve the white balls so they act like the red balls, and we can't because it's never happened. If that's the case, then I think naturally the scores are going to go up in white ball cricket and you're going to get fewer wickets. I think that makes perfect sense.
Yeah, thank you.
No worries. Great question. All right. I got Path.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah. So what kind of experience do you think test match batsman requires? Like, I'm looking at the four current Indian test match batsmen, you know, Prithvi Shaw, Shubman Gill, Mayank Agarwal and KL Rahul. And of course, there's Rohit Sharma. So like these guys they have like 15 years of experience, 7 years of experience, like heavy competitive test cricket. They have different levels of experience, but they are like similarly useful. Like you can select any two of them and expect them to do well. And you know, so what kind of experience might be required to select an opener properly? Or is it just that they keep doing well and you keep selecting them?
It's a really interesting question. I mean, with Rohit Sharma, he has not faced enough balls outside of India, really, or Asia, opening the batting yet for him probably to feel completely comfortable doing the job. In a perfect world, what you would probably do is, let's say you had a young Indian opener, you would send them to play county cricket around the age of 18, 19, 20. And you would get them to play, you know, a season or two of that. So they got used to the ball moving the most possible, the most lateral that we get. You would then spend a lot of time with A tours, probably in Australia and South Africa, or at least one or the other, so that they get used to pitches that have higher bounce. And then once you've done that, it's just getting them to play as much as possible. But that's not how we develop test players. Can't think of anyone who really does that. Maybe England tried to do that. Zach Crawley's father did it because Zach Crawley was, you know, comes from a wealthy family. But it's not a natural thing to be able to do. But realistically, that is how you would do it. But that's not how modern test cricket is played. Modern test cricket is you have to get by on your natural ability and the ability to adapt very, very late. So by that, I mean, you know, KL Rahul doesn't play any first-class cricket. He gets one warm-up game and then he's in opening the batting. That seems to be a skill that players, whether it be batters or bowlers, are having to adapt to more often than not now. And that is part of the game, I suppose. In the same way in the old days, making runs consistently was part of the game. Now, it's adapting quickly so that you can survive is part of the game. We're not setting up these players to succeed. I talked about this on the Polite Inquiries episode yesterday, where people were like, well, KL Rahul hasn't played any first-class cricket and he made 50, so why are we complaining that all these other guys haven't played any first-class cricket? If you want players to make runs consistently, you have to allow them to play consistently. They have to be tested in all different places. They have to learn their game. They have to adapt. They have to have constant feedback from coaches. They have to play in multiple different areas so they can work their game in all different areas. That's not to say that KL Rahul won't make a ton of runs this particular test series. But if you want him to be a consistent test match player, he needs to play first class cricket and red ball cricket consistently. It's going to be very hard for people not to be able to do that. And you are setting up the players to fail, I believe, if you are not looking at that particular system. But yeah, it's a really good question. But we do not prepare. I'm not even sure we prepare T20 players correctly, realistically, and that's where all the money is. I think we have a very we have a very weird way of preparing cricketers. And it comes from the sort of the history of cricket, I suppose, the way that we've always played it. And now the sport is so massively different than it ever was before. And that's causing a bit of a problem. But great question. Thank you very much. I have time for one last question. There you are. Here we go. Bring it home, closer.
Yeah, I wanted to ask, how much of an effect does the bounce of the ball have on how batsmen see it? Like, in the recently concluded India-Sri Lanka series, he showed that Asaranga bent his knee to get a lower bounce, and that was causing batsman trouble. Similarly, Jameson has a weird bend kind of, and but still gets bounced. So how does it impact?
So, well, if you're facing a bowler that bowls, let's say that their natural length is 6 meters, and if you're facing Kyle Jameson, and he bounces the ball on the 6 meter part of the pitch, you're expecting the ball to bounce about 20 centimeters higher or 15 centimeters higher than an average bowler. If you're bowling with a lower bowling action, say Lasith Malinga, you're expecting the exact same 6 meter ball to be way lower. That's a completely, those are two different shots at that point. With Jameson, you can probably play a back foot shot, either defense or maybe try and punch him through the covers. With Malinga, you probably want to be on the front foot. And even though he's landing the ball around the 6 meter mark, he's still a chance of probably getting you out LBW. Whereas with Jameson, that's probably not the case because of his height. So that you've got two bowlers and two completely different extremes there, of meaning that you're going to have to play differently for each player. So that's huge. And, you know, you see it with Asian batters when they go to Australia. They come forward to balls and end up with their hand, they get hit on the gloves a lot. And you see it with, especially, I would say the pitches that's most common are, you know, Bangladesh and the UAE, where you see Western players, quite often Australian and South African players and sometimes New Zealand players, who naturally see the length and they either get stuck in the crease or they go back and the ball's just not there. So, you know, those are certainly problems that you have and you have to adapt to. I remember being told once that when the ball bounced higher than normal, Ben Stokes was one of the most elite batters in the world. When the ball bounced lower than normal, Ben Stokes really struggled. So Ben Stokes would probably prefer to face Kyle Jameson or Mornay Morkel or Mitchell Starc, even though they all cause everyone else trouble, than he would to be able to face someone like Lasith Malinga or I'm trying to think of someone else who shoots the ball through a little bit lower. Perhaps someone like Kemar Roach, who shoots the ball through a little bit lower. So, you know, different players like different things. I think that's very fair. But you certainly have to adapt your game to the way that the ball is coming through. If Kyle Jameson's pitching the ball, let's say, at 5 meters, most test players would be thinking, well, I could on a flat pitch, I can drive on the up here, and this is a flat pitch. If you try and drive Kyle Jameson on the up, chances are your bat is not going to be completely straight. It's going to be on a slight angle, and that extra bounce will take an edge. Whereas that, you're not going to get that kind of dismissal with someone with a lower ball, you know, someone who's shorter or with a lower bowling action. So the shots that you play have to be, you have to keep that in mind. I don't know if you've ever played cricket, but I always struggled with taller bowlers simply once they went above about 6 foot three or 6 foot four, I had trouble just looking up higher, which sounds really stupid, but I was so used to looking at a certain spot. Just when the hand came from that little bit higher, I really have trouble. I can usually, after a little while, get used to it after about 10 or 15 balls, but sadly, I'm not that good and I'm usually out well before then. So it is an adjustment looking slightly higher or slightly lower at different kinds of bowling actions. So it does change the shots that you can play.
So did yesterday's wicket of Kohli to Anderson, did the ball bounce extra or was it just the swing that swayed Kohli into play?
Well, Jimmy Anderson doesn't generally get extra bounce, but that particular pitch yesterday, if you have a look, there was a lot of balls that were fizzing through and basically not even making it, and some others not even making it through to the wicketkeeper. There's a lot of balls that the wicketkeepers have taken around their feet in this game, and also a lot of balls that have got, you know, Josh Butler's been hit twice in front of his face on the end of his fingers. That says to me that sometimes these balls are coming off the pitch quite fast, and sometimes these balls are coming off the pitch a bit slower. And that's not bounce. It's almost something, it affects the bounce, which might affect your shot, but that is almost something completely separate. So Jimmy Anderson can release the ball from the exact same place, six balls in a row. One will come off a bit slow. I can't remember who it was. It might've been Cale who scooped one up to point. The ball just didn't come off the wicket. I don't think his shot was particularly terrible, but it didn't come off the wicket correctly. And then you saw a lot of other edges when the ball flew through. But yeah, I don't think Anderson's was about the bounce. It might have been the pace that the ball came off the wicket, but mostly it was just about the outswing and the fact that he's Jimmy Anderson and he has 600 of those wickets. But thank you to everyone for your questions. Another very fun Spotify Green Room. So as I said, if you want to be involved, follow me on the Spotify Green Room app and you will get a notification when I go live. But you can listen to this on Red Inker if you came in halfway through. And we usually put them up on YouTube as well. There's a great podcast I did with Estelle on Sri Lankan cricket, for any of you who haven't heard it. And if you are Sri Lankan, maybe it's best that you skip it, if we're being honest, because it's not good. But for everyone else, it's right there. And we've got a bunch of really cool videos coming up on YouTube soon. We've just been falling a little bit behind on them, but there's some very entertaining ones and some very weird ones coming up. I suppose very entertaining and very weird is kind of my wheelhouse at a certain point. But thank you all for listening.
Podcast Network.
I won't let my active psoriatic arthritis joint symptoms define me.
Emerge as you. Tremfya guselkumab is proven to significantly reduce joint pain, stiffness, and swelling in adults with active psoriatic arthritis. Some patients even reported less fatigue as assessed by survey 1 week prior. Results may vary. Tremfya is taken by injection 6 times a year after 2 starter doses at week 0 and 4.
Serious allergic reactions may occur. Tremfya may increase your risk of infections and lower your ability to fight them. Before treatment, your doctor should check you for infections and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms of infection, including fever, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough. Tell your doctor if you had a vaccine or plan to.
Emerge as you. Learn more about Tremfya, including important safety information, at Tremfya.com or call 1-877-578-3527. See our ad in Food & Wine magazine. For patients prescribed Tremfya, cost support may be available.
At Amica Insurance, we know it's more than a life policy. It's about the promise and the responsibility that comes with being a new parent. Being there day and night. And building a plan for tomorrow, today. For the ones you'll always look out for, trust Amica Life Insurance. Amica. Empathy is our best policy.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
When your space has the long-lasting, noticeable scent of Airwick Vibrant Scented Oils, you'll want to invite everyone over, from book club to the fantasy league, even the in-laws.
It smells amazing.
Airwick Vibrant Scented Oils are infused with 2 times more natural essential oils versus regular Airwick scented oils for our most authentic, nature-inspired fragrance experience. Transform your space with scents like white sage and mahogany or lavender and water lily. Now that's a breath of fresh Airwick.